we welcome back to the program our friend, writer Colin Fleming. Hello there, Colin.
Roaring out of the gate with Kimball.
Yes, sir. Did you gorge yourself with Cadbury eggs on Sunday?
No, I didn't. I didn't think I deserved it. I didn't work very hard on Sunday, and to be honest with you, it was a pretty depressing day, and it's tough to enjoy. You know how it is. Cadbury eggs, it's all about that sort of revelry of the chocolate. So, no. But I did drink a lot of hibiscus tea for my blood pressure.
Excellent. Well, glad to hear that. Well, we cover a lot of topics today, as always. Let's begin with your thoughts on a couple of regional teams here and begin with the state of the Red Sox at 1-3.
1-3. That's, I don't know, man. I feel like this is going to be a long one, this particular season. I was not as sanguine as a lot of people were with this team's offense, and that's supposed to be their best attribute, right? It's not the starting pitching, and the bullpen is a problem for the last couple of years. So I think this is going to be an awfully long, dispiriting campaign.
Really? See, and I don't think they're going to be good by any stretch, but I have some optimism. I think the offense will come around. They've got too many good hitters not to score a lot of runs. Martinez already has done more than he did in the shortened season last year. And if Devers can bounce back and they get decent contributions, as I think they will, from Verdugo, I like some of the guys they've picked up. Franchi Cordero is going to be an interesting player. I think they'll score some runs. It's the pitching. Better than last year because we've actually heard of some of these guys, but we'll see. Martin Perez goes tonight. He's one of those guys who's always teasing you. He'll throw every fifth time out, he'll throw six shutout innings, and you think he's figured it out.
I don't know. I want to think that way about Verdugo, but I think he kind of topped out at the best he can be last year. What was he? He even got like MVP votes, right? He was somewhere near like top 10. I think it was around 8 or 10 or something like that. But you have a few guys who have like 20 home run, 100 RBI type of capabilities, and that just doesn't seem that much to me in this particular age of offensive-driven baseball. Martinez, there's something that really puts me off about that guy. He's just not a winning ball player to me with the whole excuses last year and the whole idea that he needs to have his technology. Like, I think that's really strange that baseball, which has become so robotic, allows you to sort of further automate the sport by consulting with your technology in the dugout in between at bats. And I feel like that should be left out until the next game. Do that on your kind of own time. Once the game starts, it should be the players on the field and like it is really in the other sports. So I don't know. Devers is someone who I feel like some of these guys play for Cora maybe more than they would for somebody else. And I think the Cora move was a weird sort of step backwards. That was really, it's like this ex-girlfriend you have, and it's like it didn't work out, and you have these feelings, and you're going to go back. It's never a good idea to go back. It's always a good idea to, I mean, I don't know, maybe a guy like you, you've been divorced and then you remarried the wife that you were divorced from. I don't know your circumstances. You're an interesting guy. But I feel like it's best, you see that like sometimes in sitcoms, right? Like people get remarried again. But I think it's best to move forward. And I just have a bad sort of 70 win sort of feeling about this team.
Oh, yeah. So I put them somewhere in the mid-80s. But look, who really knows? We're throwing darts. How about the Bruins? I say they take a big step forward tonight because they're starting former Maine Black Bear Jeremy Swayman in net.
Oh, he's getting the start. I didn't even see that yet. That must be his first, right?
It is, yeah.
Their start. Yeah, they're in some trouble. And I think that the only reason they might not be in trouble, although I was maybe perhaps reacting too soon with this, is because the team behind them, the Flyers, have been the sort of faltering mess for a while. And I thought, okay, the Bruins are going to get this fourth playoff spot simply because of the team that is chasing them. But now the way that the math is starting to shake out here, and that extra point was big last night. I know that the Bruins at least got the one. Flyers are right there. And this Bruins team is, to me, they're on some kind of last legs. I'm seeing that they don't have much of a chance if they don't, not to knock your guy, but if they don't have Rask back, they're in some real trouble. Because when they're dependent on Halak, people forget Halak, he's like 34, 35 years old. He's not like the same Halak who stole that playoff series against the Capitals in, what was that, 2010, when he was on the Canadiens, who really just stole it the last three games. He was like pretty bad before that. And they don't have that goaltending. And I'm watching Patrice Bergeron's game slip. And I know he's deified in the New England area, but he is fast becoming to me a guy who's not a number one NHL center. And I know he's sort of like wiped out last night, right? And that allowed that breakaway that won it in overtime. But he's sort of being carried to some points by his line mate. And he's gone awfully quiet, I've noticed, in a lot of games. And he's becoming their fourth or their fifth best player at this point. I think I'm most heartened by the development of Charlie McAvoy, because I was wondering if he was going to take that next step where he's very proactive. He's very animate, I would say, in the offensive zone in ways that he was not prior to this season. Like, if you notice, he's below the hash marks a lot, and he wouldn't have done that before. So he's skating better through the offensive zone. He's being more involved, I think, offensively, because he seems to me a guy who should be able to be a 60-point-a-year defenseman, which would put him like really in like a sort of Norris trophy nomination every year. But Marchand is, they're going as he tends to go, and Pasternak, and I just don't see a lot of scoring depth there, and they could fall right out of this.
Well, that's the key thing, I think, is that lack of scoring depth, and Cassidy's changed up the lines a little bit to see if that would help. But I think Don Sweeney has really failed this team by not going out and getting somebody.
I don't know that, like, they look at it. If Sweeney's failed the team, it would seem to me with this almost kind of over-reliance on the core. And it's ironic because you don't know the way that injuries are going to shake out. And I certainly, when he was logging 26 minutes tonight, I was not a huge booster of his. But this is a team that could use, I sort of hate to say it, I'm a nice guy that he is, they could use Chara right now rather than having the sort of like rented defenseman being pressed in, like the seventh defenseman, right? That's getting pressed into service every night now. But I don't know. Maybe they need to break up that first line. But I'm not sure that Bergeron can carry enough of the offensive load himself. I think he's sort of lucking into some secondary assists because of the guys he's playing with. I mean, right now, Brad Marchand, and he sort of has a narrow window of opportunity to do this because he's getting older too. This is his Hall of Fame push that you're seeing with him right now. This is his chance these last 5 or 6 years. And he only has like another year or two, maybe, at this kind of above a point a game production level. And he's being asked to do an awful lot. He carries a lot of defensive responsibilities for a wing. And normally that's like a more of a center type of thing, but he's very involved in all three zones, and his skating game is a big part of his productivity, and eventually that goes. And I think you're starting to see that go somewhat with Bergeron, where he doesn't have the legs to keep up with his two line mates.
All right, now one of the great debates in hockey: who's better, Crosby or Ovechkin? What do you think?
I would have never recommended that we talk about this because it's such a silly, nonsensical debate to me, but I was seeing these debates. I shouldn't look at Twitter. It doesn't do me any good. It gets me down quite a bit because you'll see someone and they'll be like, you know who the best ever are? The Stamkos, Sid the Kid, Ovi has to be in there, McDavid. And then you'd think that that's like some 22-year-old meathead, and I'll look up the guy. He's like 48. So like, how can you think that? How can you, first of all, the first four are the top four. But then it's like really gets interesting when who's in the discussion for the fifth best player in the history of the league. I was thinking about this today. And, I mean, who is it? Like, is it Bobby Hull? Is it sort of dark horse candidate that I like? But maybe he's not flashy enough. Ray Bourque for career value. Is it a goalie like Sawchuk? But the guy you can also make a real argument for is Sidney Crosby. He is a much better player. Much more complete player, a much more three-zone dominant player than Alexander Ovechkin. As much as I like Ovechkin, he doesn't have any business being in that sort of like conversation for top 10. He's like a top 20 kind of guy. Like, is Ovechkin better than Mark Messier? Is he better than Mike Bossy? You think, like, well, they're both goal scorers. Bossy had a season. I know it was the 80s, but still. Where he had 83 assists, and he was a good defensive player, too, in Al Arbor's system. So really what Ovechkin has become is a very one-dimensional player. He's sort of like a prettier version and a better version of Dino Cicerelli. Remember Cicerelli? He'd score all his goals from within 5 feet of the net, and he wouldn't do anything else. Ovechkin sets up on that left wing faceoff dot, and he one-times the puck. Occasionally, he trucks somebody, and I was encouraged by his game at the start of the year because he had more assists than goals. And that tells me that, okay, he has more balance to his output. But then he wasn't scoring enough goals, and he went back to that guy who's sort of like 45 goals and 24 assists. So you're not getting like the sort of well-rounded game that you're getting with Crosby. And the thing about Crosby, too, he's not just a three-zone player. He's a corner player. And Ovechkin, he might run you, but he doesn't have that dexterity. He doesn't even go into the corners or behind the net. He doesn't go down low at both ends of the ice the way Crosby does. So it's like a really weird argument to me. And I almost think of, like, at one point, Ovechkin, he just overpowered the game. He was like a really great punk rock band and like The Clash. And they'd have like these different albums, but you're also kind of just really knowing what you're also getting with The Clash or the Sex Pistols or whoever it is, that raw power. Whereas Crosby's more of a, he's more of a jazz artist. He's more of a Miles Davis in terms of his versatility. And his game has morphed. I don't even think now that Connor McDavid is a better player at present than Sidney Crosby, because I see in McDavid a guy who's sort of like a super fast peewee, and he doesn't have anywhere near the three zone dominance that Crosby has, and he doesn't have Crosby's hockey sense.
It's interesting looking at the numbers too. Ovechkin has scored right about 250 more goals. Crosby has roughly 250 more assists, and their total points are within a half dozen of each other through all these years. Now, what about the accusations? I don't watch closely enough to know and be able to say it, but is Crosby a complete flopper out there?
Well, one thing first, when you mention those totals aren't really germane. It's points per game. Crosby's missed a lot more games than Ovechkin has had played. Now, if you want to say that, okay, Ovechkin has been healthier than Crosby, that's fine. But Crosby has a much higher bang for your buck per game across his NHL career.
Right, Ovechkin's played, I think it's 168 more games.
Yeah, so it's a lot. It just gives you, like, Crosby's issue has been, not like he's always hurt, he's not, like, brittle, but he's missed significant time. It's cost him some Art Ross trophies, probably a heart or two, probably a heart to Ovechkin in one instance. As for the flopper thing, to me, that's gamesmanship, but I also think there's something about the mega elite athletes who, Brady is this way. Bruce Pratt, he gets really upset, right, that Brady gets these calls, and he's always carping for the calls. But I think when you're like a different level than everyone else, you're attuned to the game. Not that Crosby doesn't do his whole theatricality, milk it thing. I mean, I have a friend, you know, Norbert. He loathes Crosby. Like, he can't stand this guy because he whines, and then he gets the puck on his stick and, like, remember the gold medal goal? He gets that goal, like, after just, like, annoying you the entire game. But it's like, you have to think, when Crosby, his entire time when he was coming up through various leagues, he was, like, tackled and brutalized and all of these things, and he didn't go down because he was that much of a stronger player and skater than everyone else. So it's harder for a guy like that to get a penalty called against him. Like, imagine him when he was 15. Like playing against like sophomore high school like age type of guys, so I think that becomes ingrained in you. Whereas Ovechkin has this kind of, his quote about Russian tank doesn't break, and he's a much more stoic sort of player, which I think is sort of like reflected in where he comes from. It's not like Vladimir Krutov and Slava Fetisov were like whining up and down the ice.
Right.
I mean, they were Russian tanks rolling through whomever they needed to roll through. So I think that's part of Ovechkin's bloodline.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. Let's move to a new piece you've got in the Smart Set, smartset.com. all about Jimmy Blanton, the great baseball player. And you say that Blanton was the man who freed the Ellington Sound. What do you mean by that?
He was. He was the lead, well, obviously he was the lead bassist, but he was the lead player within the Ellington group. Now, someone might think, I listened to early Metallica, and the bass is the lead instrument. That's fine. But nobody had done this before Jimmy Blanton, who died at 23 years old, sort of like give us some perspective, too, on age. So this is happening in a very short amount of time. But Ellington was so enthralled, not just by the sound and the tone of Blanton, but by what Blanton could do as this kind of sonic liberator, that when you went to see Duke Ellington's, it was a dance band at the time, you went to see the dance band, sitting at the front, like the main guy, like he was Hendrix, was Jimmy Blanton, which is like crazy, because the bass was this keeping the beat in conjunction with the drums kind of instrument. It wasn't even really meant to be heard by the people who were there or the people listening to the records. It was meant more to keep the time for everybody else. So it was this harmonic instrument, really. And Blanton was like, no, I'm going to provide counterpoint. I'm going to provide dialogue with what you're doing with my pizzicato, and he'd bust out the bow for these arco approaches to bass. And this is before people plugged in. So you also had to have this real power, but also this subtlety and this finesse to your sound. You could make the argument that in jazz, with so many virtuosos, Charlie Parker on alto, and Art Tatum on piano, and John Coltrane on tenor sax, or Ben Webster in this particular Duke Ellington band, because they were called the Blanton Webster Band. But you could make the argument that no one in all of jazz was better at their instrument than Jimmy Blanton was at his.
And you say that the recordings that he and Ellington did together, their duet recordings, might be the summit of the bass.
Yes. So this is, when we say Duke Ellington to people, depressingly now, people probably don't even know who he is. But if you do, you think of him as a songwriter. You don't, like, if you, I'm sure there are a lot of people who know that Duke Ellington wrote songs. But if you said, what did he play? People don't even know it's the piano. Like, you don't think of him as a pianist. Count Basie was a pianist. I mean, what was he going to do? Stand up there with a guitar? So he was this very minimalistic type of piano player. And he got together where it was just him and Blanton. And it would seem like you wouldn't be able to make recordings of these two instruments, with Ellington being one of the players, duetting with each other. It would seem like it would be really sparse, like there wouldn't be enough to fill up the sound space. But you listen to these duets, it's like listening in on the best dialogue you've ever heard in a movie that sort of has its bona fides because of its dialogue. That's how moving it is. It's like one of those great sort of talking films, but it's these two guys, just the piano and the bass. And Blanton, I mean, it couldn't have happened with another bassist but Blanton. I think he elevates Ellington to a certain level, and I'm sure that Ellington was thinking, okay, I'm going to be elevated to this particular level. But it's like, wow, you hear the voice-like quality of Blanton's bass more so than you even do within the big ensemble, when it's prominent there. But yeah, I think, I don't know that you can have better jazz bass playing than that.
And now I need to go back and listen again to Sophisticated Lady to hear his bow work.
Right, his arco style. So it's like when we think of the jazz bass player, he has like the big axe, right? And he's slapping away at that thing. And a guy like Kimball, you probably have that image in your mind, like that hipster, that jive cat with the little beret on your head. You'd look good in one of those. And there he is doing his thing, but he would pull out a bow. It was, must have been like going to see Led Zeppelin in like Dazed and Confused, and Jimmy Page is like, behold my bow, right? Because you wouldn't have expected that on the thing that's about the Ellington Band, and I think this is kind of lost in the translation of history, is this is where you went with a hot date to dance your ass off. It was for dancing. And it's just also this art music, which I love that dichotomy. But he would pull out the bow, and he would do his thing, and he could just play it any sort of like way. He was one of those, to put it in hockey terms, it's like the 1982 New York Islanders. They could beat you with finesse, flying up and down the ice. They could grind it out, dump and chase, play a defensive game, lock it down, whatever. That was Jimmy Blanton on the base.
And finally, we take a little trip to the town of Shady Lane, Vermont, for I think maybe my favorite of all the episodes I've listened to of yours truly, Johnny Dollar, the Shady Lane Matter.
Is this your favorite because you're a New England homer?
Well, I think so. And because, you know, we all make fun of the Murder, She Wrote accents and the poor attempts that so many have done through the years of capturing that. And everybody in the cast nailed it in this. And also in the fact that, you know, like Maine towns, like Massachusetts towns, not every character has an accent. And to me, that also made it that much more real.
Yeah, I was stunned when I heard that, because if you live in these parts, I mean, I don't need to tell you, you know when it's fake. You know when people can't do it. You hear it in films all the time. People from Boston try to do a Boston accent, and they fail. And this is not a Boston accent in this film. It's a New England accent, which is like a very different sort of kettle of fish. Like, the New Englander, these kind of New Englanders have a way of, like, a good test word would be like the word scallop. Like, you'd be able to tell, like, right away, or cod, something like that, with like the kind of like extended vowel sound in it. And Johnny Dollar, he is called up to this fictional town in Vermont, which is kind of supposed to be like every town in Vermont, because this woman who was an invalid who lived on a farm was shot when she was sitting in her living room. And there's a $10,000 insurance policy, and the insurance agency, they get this letter, this anonymous letter saying, you want to look into this. So Johnny Dollar goes up there. And I think one of my favorite characters, I'll say one of my favorite characters in any kind of fiction, is the constable in this particular episode. Mm. And I think this is truly one of the great New England works of art. I think it's that good. I listen to this, I go to bed listening to this particular episode every night for like the last 2 months, because it delves into this notion, this idea, this conundrum of what is a person's nature.
Yes.
And the way that term is discussed is in all of these different sort of keys. It's very much like a fugue, like this meditation on nature. And it reminds me of, for instance, the parable from Aesop of the scorpion and the frog, which we also are going to see in Mr. Arkadin with Orson Welles. And that whole scene about the sharks and Lady from Shanghai, right? When Michael's on the beach and he's talking to these guys. But it's even deeper here. And so this particular constable is like, no, it's not her husband. He didn't do it. And Johnny Dollar, it was the most competent person in like any kind of fiction. Says, well, what do you mean he didn't do it? You don't know that. He was the beneficiary. And the constable just says, well, isn't his nature. And like, he riffs on it all these different, and he's so like implacable with how he says this. And they have these excursions together where they go off into the like the woods, like the easement kind of between these two houses where this murder was taking place. And you don't see how it's coming, who actually did it. And when you find out who did it and the way they just kind of like give themselves over, I mean, it's so believable, too.
Yeah, and the dialogue, as it is in all of the Johnny Dollar episodes, is just terrific. Crackling when it's Johnny and the constable. And then I love the scenes with Johnny Dollar and Mrs. Preeny when she explains life on a farm isn't easy on a woman.
Right, and they sort of, they dance around certain issues without dancing around them. And the 75-minute episodes, so this is one of those from that 13-month run we've talked about. And it's interesting because if you heard like 30-minute episodes, you'd have a totally different take, because a lot of lines that we savor here would be excised. Like sometimes there are just comments to make comments. And to bring up Orson Welles again, he would say that he had a hard time with his films when they were edited because the bits that didn't move the narrative forward would be taken out. And he said, those are my best bits. So there are lines like that that are just like the kind of natural sway of human interaction. And you might think, like, okay, but it's not advancing the plot. I'd say it is, because it's enhancing the relationship. And that other line that's going to follow is going to have greater gravity because you believe in the relationship. You believe in that kind of actual human valiance between these two people. And the people can change. Like, for instance, when Johnny Dollar, he goes up and the constable rides him out into the town, and he says, we'll go up to the farm. And they stop, and they see this guy who is putting up this rock wall in front of his house because it's cheaper. Do you notice how the constable gives him the business? Like, this guy is, like, really kind of severe. But the constable truncates his name, and he kind of takes the piss a little bit. And Johnny Dollar is actually admiring the way he's pulling these rocks together so they fit. And, like, there's actual awe in his voice, like, quiet awe when he says, looks difficult. And the guy, like, sort of gives him a little, like, tutorial on how he's able to do this. But that's how we sound, right? We'd show up and be like, oh, Kimball, that's pretty cool what you're doing there. So you know where you get that? You get that in Tolstoy. You don't get that in Dostoevsky. You get it in Tolstoy. It's like New England freaking Tolstoy in Vermont. I mean, it's populist. It's art. That's why I'm always banging on about these Johnny Dollar things, because, like I told you before, this is one of the great artistic discoveries of my life. And people are like, oh, no, he's being hyperbolic.
No.
Go listen to this.
That's brilliant.
I'm not. I'm underselling it.
Yeah, absolutely brilliant. I wish Tom Bosley had listened to that episode before he took on Murder, She Wrote. Colin Fleming with us. His newest book is Meatheads Say the Realest Things, a satirical short novel of the last bro. Check out his website as well, ColinFlemingLit.com. And, of course, subscribe to the Many Moments More podcast. Colin, thank you, my friend. We'll do it again next week.
Okay, sounds good, sir.